It's almost too easy, but kind of have to start today with this.
What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton.
Right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 20th of April. Great to have you along, everybody, as always. The numismatic news of the day, of course, isn't that Alexander Hamilton is staying on the $10 bill. That's been in the wind for a while now. The Treasury Secretary alluded to as much when I spoke to him last week. It is that Jack Lew has decided Andrew Jackson is not going to be on the face of the 20 anymore.
Today, I'm excited to announce that for the first time in more than a century, the front of our currency will feature the portrait of a woman, Harriet Tubman, on the $20 note.
More about money later on in the broadcast. Jackson, by the way, gets moved to the backside of the 20. It's going to be the year 2020 or so before we see the new bill, because between design and manufacturing, it is an industrial process, making new money, you know. This has been, moving on, an interesting week for health insurance companies. United Health is pulling out of most Obamacare exchanges. Cigna says it's expanding in those same exchanges. And Anthem is going to team up with a bunch of hospitals in Wisconsin to form a new insurance company entirely. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports that what we are seeing is an industry adapting to a changing market in real time.
What insurers like Anthem, United, and Cigna offer that all hospitals crave is data. Data that help hospitals keep patients out of expensive care.
We know that we write a prescription for an individual, right? We don't necessarily know that that individual fulfilled that prescription.
But John Foley, Senior VP of the Wisconsin Hospital System and head of the new joint venture with Anthem, says that should change now.
We're going to ask, why did it happen? Was there a social issue? Was there an economic issue?
The answers to those questions can translate into rich profits for those hospitals. That's why some systems are looking to get into the insurance business. But University of Minnesota's Steve Parenti says insurers want to head them off.
You, the provider, are not an insurance company. You are not qualified to do that. We are prepared to work with you so that we can be your intel inside.
Parenti says both United and Anthem flashed that very sales pitch this week. While United is backing off Obamacare exchanges, the company's consultancy arm, Optum, is thriving in the data game. Its revenues grew 54% over last year to nearly $20 billion. Anthem's deal in Wisconsin sends the same message to potential clients: open for business. John Bertko, an actuary, says insurers are doing something that was largely unthinkable in the past.
They're used to having nose-to-nose confrontation with hospitals, and to move to a thing where it's collaborative is really a change in direction.
The race is on to find the path to lower healthcare costs and improve patient care, even though no one has proven this concept works. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
All right, new topic. Best guesses are that there are 400,000 pre-orders for Tesla's newest electric car, the Model 3. EVs, as the category is called, electric vehicles, are a big part of the U.S. strategy to fight carbon emissions and global warming. With all those plug-in cars, though, comes a need for someplace to plug them in, charging stations. And much as the car industry is having some growing pains around electrification, so too is the charging industry. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
California leads the way for the U.S. electric vehicle market. The state has a goal of getting 1 million EVs on the road by 2020 and 500,000 more by 2025. There are estimates it'll take at least 120,000 easily accessible charging stations to accommodate those cars. Right now, there's about one-sixth of what's needed. The three major utilities companies in California are putting together pilot programs to get about 12,000 more around the state. Saj Constantine at the Center for Sustainable Energy says that's not a huge number.
But if it opens up the market, if it creates a demand on the part of consumers to buy EVs and to use them because they know that infrastructure can be made available, then we will see a nonlinear, an exponential growth.
The problem is that one of the pilot programs, by Pacific Gas and Electric, is controversial because some think it's too large and could stifle competition. How large? The plan is 7,600 charging ports, down from the 25,000 the company originally wanted. Damon Conklin is with the Electric Vehicle Charging Association. He says if a program that large is approved, rival companies would find it hard to compete.
And there are areas where an investor-owned utility can come in and help enhance and grow, but not completely take over.
He says the number of companies getting into the charging game is growing steadily. As they fight for a slice of the ever-increasing pie, the competition could get messy. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Wall Street today could have used some gas. That's all I'm saying. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A couple of months ago, we came out with the latest set of results from our Marketplace Edison Research Economic Poll. Lots of good things in there, not least of which was finding out that 59% of Americans would find it somewhat or very difficult to come up with the cash to meet an unexpected expense of $1,000. Unbeknownst to us, the Federal Reserve has been asking a similar question in its public polling, whether people could come up with $400 if they had to. Short answer is no. Neil Gabler is one of those people. He's a writer, a good one too, published in Everything, makes his living at it. He has written about his and this country's financial precariousness in the new issue of The Atlantic magazine. Neil, it's good to have you on.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
You get right to it in this piece. You couldn't come up with $400 if you had to.
That is true. And I knew that about myself. The surprise for me was that I was not alone. I discovered when I looked at some data, the Federal Reserve study of household income, that 47% of the American people could not come up with $400. And I thought perhaps there would be some solace to other people out there to know that they were not alone.
Well, you point out early in this piece that you are more likely to, one is more likely to know that a buddy is taking Viagra than to know that he has credit card problems.
Well, I coined the term for this piece, financial impotence.
Yeah, I love that one. It was a little painful to read, but it was great, you know.
Yeah. Well, it struck me that that's exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about something that is so shameful that people will not share it with even their closest friends or even with their family.
So let's take one American. You write about your choices, I guess, right? And how you wound up where you are, a man of a certain age with grown daughters who has nothing in the bank. What happened?
You're right, Kai. It was painful. It was painful to live it.
Yeah.
But what happened to me was life. You know, I made choices, as I think we all do. I mean, choices to live in New York City, which is an expensive place. Choices to become a writer. A choice to, you know, get married, to have children, to send those children to private school because I didn't think that the public school was adequate. Mm. And, you know, the choices go on and on and on. Yeah. But these are the choices we all make. But when we sort of reflect on our lives, we say if we hadn't made those choices, maybe we wouldn't be in the place we are financially, which is not a particularly good place, but we wouldn't be who we are. Hmm. So there's a kind of metaphysical component to this financial disaster and financial impotence.
One of the things you talk about, actually, is that to look at you, to pass you on the street, a person would never know that you were having these kinds of problems. And in fact, before we turn on the microphones, I complimented you on a biography of Walt Disney that you wrote a number of years ago. And when I read this article and put two and two together, I was like, no way. Come on, that guy who wrote that cool book is right. It sort of doesn't add up.
Well, you look at me and you're absolutely right. You would say there is no way that this guy would have financial difficulty. And even, to be perfectly honest, if you looked at my 1040, you wouldn't say that this guy should be having financial difficulty, but that's precisely the point. Financial impotence doesn't strike simply the poor, who by definition, you know, have a difficult time making ends meet. It strikes the middle class especially hard, the upper middle class, and even the very upper reaches, because there's a very basic formula at work here. You know, too little money in income, too great expenses.
There are a couple of things that you point to as proximate causes. One is, and there's a whole bunch of factors, obviously, but one is the easy availability of credit in this economy at a time of stagnating wages and the struggle to keep up.
That is what economists talk about when they try and focus on, to the extent that they do, why people cannot make ends meet. And part of it is that credit was easy. And when credit is easy and incomes are stagnant, which is the situation that we've been in for quite a few decades in this country, not just years, but decades in this country, what people do is they will borrow to meet the gap between their income and their expenses. I did that, although that was not the primary reason I was underwater. But I think it is a major reason why so many other Americans are underwater.
You are yourself on the way to financial repair, right?
I wouldn't say that.
Hmm.
I wouldn't say that at all. What I would say is that I'm on the way toward trying to pay down whatever debt I have. And the way I conclude this piece is, you know, I talk about a Bruce Eric Kaplan cartoon where, you know, we thought it was just a rough patch. It turned out to be our life.
Hmm.
And I say, you know, that may very well be the truth for a great many Americans, myself included. So I'm not certain that this is a story, my own personal story or the national story, has a particularly happy ending.
Neil Gabler's piece in The Atlantic is called The Secret Shame of Middle-Class Americans. There's a link to it on our website. There is also information on our Economic Anxiety Index and what we had to say, or what we found, rather, when we asked people about the ability to meet an unexpected expense. Neil, thanks very much for your time. Interesting piece.
Thank you so very much.
When an economy changes, people and governments can fight it or they can adapt. With No More Than That as setup, this from Harvest Media's Luke Runyon in Denver, Colorado.
The Governor's Forum on Agriculture in Denver is your typical farm conference. Every year, farmers in denim and cowboy hats mingle with ag professionals. The governor himself swings by for a keynote speech. But this year, there was a new addition.
I'd like to thank everybody for showing up to the Cannabis and Emerging Crop of Colorado panel.
Cannabis, an emerging crop of Colorado. In years past, marijuana growers haven't been invited to the event. Now, Dwayne Sinning, the state regulator in charge of industrial hemp, is introducing three cannabis company executives.
There's an opportunity where traditional agriculture can help an industry emerge in this state.
Because cannabis is the state's newest and flashiest cash crop, there's a focus on finding the most efficient ways to grow it, to turn cannabis into a commodity like wheat or corn.
This is basically the brain of our company right here.
Stephen Lipton is the cultivation manager at The Farm, a recreational and medical marijuana operation in Boulder, Colorado. Before this, Lipton worked as an organic farmer. We're in his lab, a room filled with at least 150 different strains of marijuana planted in small pots.
Genetics, like, is really the cornerstone of the whole thing, in my opinion. You know, I mean, without that, you know, you really have nothing.
Just like a plant breeder attempting to make a sweeter apple or a heartier tomato, he crosses strains in search of the perfect variety.
Plant vigor, smell, aroma, taste, yeah. Anything that you can really imagine. Yield is a big one for sure.
Most of modern agriculture relies heavily on inputs, like fertilizers and pesticides, to keep plants healthy and productive. But for obvious legal reasons, the Monsantos and John Deeres of the world aren't catering to cannabis growers. That leaves room for startups.
How's it going, Colin?
Good. Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
It's very nice to meet you. Come on
in Fort Collins, research scientist Colin Bell originally wanted to cater to vegetable growers, but now sells his beneficial soil microbes by the gallon to marijuana growers under the brand name Mammoth.
You know, we hear bigger flowers, we hear denser flowers, which actually, in the end, it translates to more yield, right?
And more yield translates to more money. In Colorado alone, marijuana sales were just shy of $1 billion in 2015. And with more markets coming online, Bell says a lot of farmers want in on the ground floor.
It's a super exciting opportunity from a business perspective. You know, there hasn't been a new market in many, many, many years, and there might not be one again in our lifetime.
That same excitement is on display back at the Governor's Forum on Agriculture in Denver. Grant Mativi farms potatoes and barley in the state's parched San Luis Valley. Last season, he gave hemp a try. In a region prone to drought, he likes the crop's ability to withstand dry conditions.
To be successful and to get this industry really going on its feet, that we need to involve farmers a little bit more rather than basement weed growers.
At first, Mativi says he was skeptical about jumping onto the bandwagon in the rush to grow cannabis. Now, he says he just needs to figure out how to run his combine over it. In Fort Collins, Colorado, I'm Luke Runyon for Marketplace.
Coming up.
What is the choice? The choice is, according to Prime Minister Abe, that Japanese will eventually disappear.
They could also choose babies. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 42 points today, about 0.25%. Ended things at 18,096. The NASDAQ up 7 points, about 0.1%. Finished at 4,948. The S&P 500 climbed a point, less than 0.1%, 2102 there. Market's got a big boost from a climb in oil prices. U.S. crude up 3.8% today, $42.63 a barrel if you're keeping track. We talked about United Healthcare earlier. Shares in that company, big movers, climbing 2.6%. Potential buyers for Yahoo got a glimpse into that company's problems last night when the company detailed an 18% drop in revenue. Shares, however, because this is capitalism, up 4% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.84%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Television is a dog-eat-dog business. You get the ratings or you don't. And ABC's flagship morning show, Good Morning America, hasn't been, at least not in the way the corporate bosses at Disney expect. So changes are afoot. ABC announced yesterday that Michael Strahan's going to leave the network's mid-morning offering Live with Kelly and Michael and become a full-time anchor on GMA beginning in September. The Kelly of Live with Kelly and Michael, Kelly Ripa, is said to be plenty steamed. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, when it comes to those morning news shows, there ain't no messing around.
Apparently, some humans enjoy mornings. They watch things like this.
Good Morning America.
Or this.
This is Today.
Or this.
Welcome to CBS This Morning.
About 13 million morning people in total tune in for celebrities, news, weather, and pep.
Okay, I've got the button. Here's the confetti.
But don't let those perky smiles and sunshiny French horn theme music fool you.
We call these the morning show wars. This is ultra competitive, especially between NBC and ABC.
Brian Stelter hosts Reliable Sources on CNN and is author of Top of the Morning. Good Morning America is winning in total viewers, but losing ground among key younger demographics, and that is worrisome.
Mornings are where the money is. It is where networks make hundreds of millions of dollars.
Networks love morning shows because the profit margins are so high. John Swallen is with Kantar Media Group.
News programming is less expensive to produce than entertainment programming.
Morning shows are also strategically critical to networks because they are live. Andrew Tyndall publishes the Tyndall Report.
News, by definition, is live content rather than taped content. So it's very hard for Netflix or Amazon or HBO to compete head-to-head with the networks in news.
Given all this, it made sense for ABC to poach Michael Strahan from Live and put him on Good Morning America, as heartbreaking as that might be for fans of Live. The world of morning show TV isn't so smiley and perky after all, is it, morning people? In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Japan, the third largest economy on this planet, has a population of plus or minus 128 million people. For now. Thing is that they are just not having enough babies in Japan. Before the end of the century, the Japanese population is going to be half of what it is today. Plummeting birth rates are a problem in other big economies, Italy and Germany, to name just a couple. But in Japan, as Marketplace's Sally Herships reports, the baby problem is inherently tied to ideas about the workplace.
If you think you work long hours, meet Kumi Matsumoto.
It's very normal for us to stay until midnight, and sometimes we have to stay until early in the morning next day.
Matsumoto lives in Tokyo. She's 41, and when we met, she was on maternity leave from her government job. But when she's in the office, often she doesn't get her assignments until late at night. She says the hours can be brutal, especially for women with kids.
Some ask their mother for everything about their family. I mean, one of them I know met her child only on weekends.
Matsumoto says, okay, that was an extreme case. But because of the long hours Japanese workers are expected to put in, working mothers here have to ask for a ton of help, much more than a typical American parent.
Mothers, babysitters, nurses, schools, and somehow managed to do it. But I know many women couldn't do that much and just quit.
Or what's becoming even more common, they just don't have kids at all. Japan's population is shrinking fast. Yu Kurakawa is with Japan's National Institute of Population and Social Security Research. He showed me a report on the future of the country's population. It's 42 pages long, but bottom line, the numbers don't look good.
In 2060, Japanese total population will become
86.74 million. Yeah. Now it's 128. Oh my God. Japan's population is expected to shrink in half by the year 2082. That's right, in half. Kurakawa says the population decline is mainly due to economics. Real estate is expensive, and if you work long hours, you have to pay for childcare. It's simple math. People just can't afford to have big families. The magic number here is 2.1. That's how many kids Japanese families need to have, on average, to keep up with population losses. But they're only having 1.4 kids. What makes the situation even worse is while we know how to decrease the number of babies being born, it can be really difficult for a country to increase that number. But Japan's government is trying. Akiko Ito is deputy director of Japan's headquarters for overcoming population decline and revitalizing local economies.
The countryside has a relatively high birth rate, but Tokyo has a very low birth rate.
So Ito says the government is trying to get people to move to the country. She says Japan is spending 2 trillion yen over the next 5 years to try to add new jobs and businesses in the countryside. But it's trying to make workplaces friendlier for families in the country and the city, encouraging shorter hours, telecommuting, and even helping foot the bill for matchmakers. All the single ladies and men, listen up. If you're searching for a mate and enjoy country life, you may want to consider Japan. Suhiro Matsuzaka is a matchmaker in Hanamaki, a small city in the north.
So he likes going to the gym, going to restaurants, eating seafood, going out to eat.
Matsuzaka has 2 notebooks. Peach for women, yellow for men, and because this is Japan, there is a cute illustration of the single man or woman instead of a photo. But single guys in Hanamaki, the odds here are not in your favor. So how many members do you have?
Male membership, 140, and female membership, 110.
Matsuzaka says young women here tend to leave for the city. Still, he says he marries about 10 couples a year, a pretty solid success rate. But he's just one matchmaker in one tiny city. What do you think the solution is?
None.
There is no solution.
Japan's population is rapidly shrinking. Linda Lim researches business and economic development in Asia at the University of Michigan. She says Prime Minister Abe has called for changes in the role of women at home and throughout the country's corporate culture, but he's been met with resistance.
What is the choice? The choice is, according to Prime Minister Abe, that Japanese will eventually disappear. Even at that very, very extreme, you know, it's staring in your face. You're already shrinking in population year after year, and yet you refuse to change.
Lim says that shows how deep the country's cultural beliefs and traditional values run. She says Japan is stuck, fighting itself. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, more money. The current lineup of dead white guys on our currency has been the way it is since 1928, hence the changes. And the 20, by the way, is not the only change. The back of the $10 bill is going to celebrate the women's suffrage movement with pictures of Lucretia Mott, Sojourner Truth, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Alice Paul on it. The 5, with Lincoln still on the front, yes, is going to have Martin Luther King Jr., Marian Anderson, and Eleanor Roosevelt on the back. Also, and I thought this was kind of cool, the new bills are going to have what are called tactile features to make it easier for the blind and visually impaired to use paper money and thus participate in this economy, right? The Treasury Department's got a whole website set up. It is modernmoney.treasury.gov. Check it out. It's all kinds of cool stuff. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 42 points today, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ up 7 points, about 0.1%. The S&P 500 up a point less than 0.1%. Gold to Arthur, John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.